The Search for Susan Fast Eagle. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, May 27th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, SDPB's spotlight on missing and murdered Indigenous women. Lee Sturbinger reports from the search for a 30-year-old mother in Rapid City. Then we cross our eastern border to Minnesota, where the state legislature has gathered detailed data and recommended action steps to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. We'll talk with leaders and researchers about those efforts. We take a moment for Spearfish, South Dakota, as baseball season opens in the city. Eric Helland has suggestions for those hardy plants for every skill level, plus music from piano man Nick Lynn later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from the Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Results from a new statewide study scratch beneath the surface of South Dakota stereotypes. The study's director says it reveals a surprising diversity of identities and experiences. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
South Dakota Public Broadcasting worked on the study with the Cheeseman Center for Democracy at the University of South Dakota. Cheeseman Center director Shane Nordyke created a data report to reflect a popular image of South Dakotans. Then she surveyed about 1,000 people across the state and conducted several virtual focus group interviews.
They represented a lot more diversity than what it was that we saw in that statewide scan.
One example came from focus group participants in Lemon. Nordyke says the rural residents near the North Dakota border defied assumptions.
They were talking about new art exhibits and sort of artists who were coming into town, new sort of places for tourists to be able to go. And they were talking a lot about opportunities for young professionals.
Nordyke also encountered surprising responses from Huron residents. She interviewed high school students whose parents immigrated from Asia to work in meatpacking plants.
I kind of had these assumptions that they would be like, oh, South Dakota, right? You know, in terms of like, there's a lot of corn and a lot of white people. But that was not their experience. They were like, oh, we love it here.
In Sioux Falls and Vermilion, Nordyke interviewed young women of color. They say there are lower expectations for them than for their white peers.
They were told like, oh, well, you don't need to go to college out of state. You don't need to retake a test. Like, you know, just this is going to be good enough.
Shane Nordyke says the survey and focus groups revealed some very specific challenges facing tribal communities.
We see that respondents who are Native American were less likely to agree that they had access to good quality medical care or that they were able to afford good quality medical care.
Funding for the study comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Coming Home Initiative. The effort supports deeper understanding of rural places. Nordyke hopes the Cheeseman Center study helps people get beyond the typical view of South Dakota as a white agrarian state.
It's not that that's not true. It's just that that's not the whole story.
The data will be released to the public June 1st at sdpb.org. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Seth Tupper.
A trial date has been set for the South Dakota Attorney General who struck and killed a man along a Hyde County highway. Jason Roundsburg will go on trial August 26th on 3 misdemeanor charges, including careless driving, operating a vehicle while on an electronic device, and driving outside his lane. The State Department of Public Safety says Roundsburg was distracted the night of September 12th, swerved out of his lane near Highmore, and struck 55-year-old Joe Beaver, who was walking on the shoulder with a flashlight. Roundsburg told officials he never saw Beaver and thought he struck a deer. Medical marijuana advocates have convinced South Dakota voters that legalizing the drug for medical use is a good idea, but they're struggling to do the same with many of the state's physicians. The South Dakota State Medical Association has concerns with the medical pot program. That's a potential problem for medical pot advocates because the new law depends on involvement from physicians. An advocate for medical pot use says that reluctance from physicians and healthcare providers could result in a bumbling rollout of the program that will ultimately hurt patients. For today's weather, we're seeing cloudy skies statewide with showers this afternoon. For SDPB News, I'm John Wynn.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Mackenzie Scott is a philanthropist, an author, and former spouse of Amazon's Jeff Bezos. In late 2020, she posted on social media about accelerating her 2020 giving efforts. She mentioned the wrecking ball of the pandemic and the need for infusions of support. She cited Emily Dickinson and asked where hope lives in our times. Then she released a list of carefully vetted organizations across the nation who were scheduled to receive her gifts. On that list, Mitchell Technical College and Lake Area Technical College in Watertown. Mike Cartney is president of Lake Area Technical College, and he's joining us now to talk about the unexpected $10 million gift. Mike Cartney, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Well, I appreciate you having us. This is truly an honor to be on your show.
Tell us, did you have any connection with Mackenzie Scott? Did you know who she was? Some kind of family thing that you've got going on?
It was kind of interesting. When we first received notification, we actually wondered if it was in fact real. But we had not applied for or had any contact prior to receiving the gift.
So Scott lays out how carefully she, sourced the places who would receive their gifts, and some of them were even put on hold if there was some kind of, concern about leadership or some kind of glitch about how the money might be spent, because she said, we've got time to make sure we do this right. Tell me a little bit about Lake Area Technical College and what it means to have had all your ducks in a row so that somebody like Mackenzie Scott could say, yes, they are ready to receive.
Well, Lake Erie Tech has quite a legacy of performance. We've won the Aspen Institute, but probably the biggest thing for this impact gift was what our students and staff here had done as far as stepping forward in support of the community with the pandemic. We had made masks, we'd made visors literally 10,000 visors for medical care workers. Our energy program used their ethanol capabilities to produce hand sanitizer for both the healthcare and the community as a whole. So there was a lot of things that the students and staff had done. In fact, this year they'd done almost 100,000 hours of community service. We were certainly pleased to be recognized, but honored by this gift.
Yeah, and I think on behalf of South Dakota listeners, thank you for those students and for your leadership during that time with the volunteer work and the community effort to be part of the solutions in such a difficult time in South Dakota and really around the world. $10 million, all right, what happens next? Because there are no strings attached to this gift.
That's true. At first you have this kind of overwhelming, somebody's just given us $10 million. And then you have this realization that, hey, someone just gave us the responsibility of $10 million of their hard-earned dollars. And how can we use this to really meet the donor's desire, which is that we have a very positive impact on the community and on our students with it. So, we're in the midst of expanding our capabilities. Workforce is a huge need in South Dakota and on a technically skilled workforce. And so we're going to use the majority of our funding to help us to expand our capabilities. In other words, we're going to do some construction and some building with it because we're currently over design capacity with our student population. So we need to meet the demands of South Dakota's workforce, and we're going to do that, but in a way that will enable us now to do that without putting any burden on our students, which is really key for us. So the ability to expand our capability and not have to put any burden on the students will be key.
Let's talk to some of those prospective students now, because high school graduates are entering the workforce or looking for their next step. And boy, this class of 2021 has had a tough year of figuring out what's canceled, what's going, a tough 2 years, really, of high school. Talk to the ones that you think might be interested in pursuing a future at Lake Area Tech.
Well, absolutely. Lake Area Tech is just an outstanding Technical School, all of the techs in South Dakota do an outstanding job, but we have a 99.4% placement rate of our graduates. Our graduates will make more than the median income of South Dakota just 5 years after they graduate. And, you know, we will graduate 75% of those that start here. The technical system in South Dakota has some of the highest retention and graduation rates in the nation. Everyone is nationally recognized and just does an outstanding job. For our grads, for our students, we're going to give you an experience that is relevant. We define success as placement, not just graduation. So we really want students who know what they want to do, and we're going to help them get there. So it's an outstanding opportunity for anybody in South Dakota or even the surrounding areas that want to come here to school.
Any final thoughts to that workforce development key piece here, a $10 million gift, a responsibility to not only serve your students, but to be part of this, you know, South Dakota employment ecosystem with help wanted signs up all over the state? What's your commitment to local businesses and businesses who might want to move to South Dakota and start their, production in the state?
Well, one of the key things is that, you know, workforce is our mission. In fact, we tout ourselves as, although we're student-focused, we are industry-facing. So we define success, and we determine whether or not we're being successful by the feedback that we receive from industry as far as our grads' performance in the workplace. And we really do focus on helping students to be outstanding, productive citizens of South Dakota when they graduate. And so that has been a hallmark of Lake Area Tech. You won't find a faculty that cares more about student success than the staff and faculty here at Lake Area. And it's just amazing when you get that kind of focus, and they're focused very much on helping our students, you know, changing lives and launching careers. And when you get that going, you can't help but have an impact on people's lives.
Philanthropist Mackenzie Scott's gift to Lake Area Technical College comes with no strings attached, $10 million, and it's part of her pledge to donate millions to hundreds of organizations in all 50 states and in Puerto Rico. Mike Cartney, president of Lake Area Tech, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you very much.
Ahead on the program, our May SDPB Spotlight explores the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports from the search for Susan Fast Eagle. You're in the moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. The Sovereign Bodies Institute reports 173 missing or murdered Indigenous women in our state. Most of those cases remain unsolved. We hear stories from the Capitol Building and Pier, where loved ones gather to call for justice. Plus, a visit to the only long-term shelter for human trafficking victims in South Dakota. That and more, Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Hi, it's Julie Rose, host of Top of Mind. Memorial Day marks the traditional beginning of summer. It's also a time to revere sacrifices made by others so that we can enjoy our freedoms. My team has put together a special hour featuring conversations about legacies and memorials. We'll learn about projects to collect soldiers' letters and to preserve veterans' memories. I hope you'll join us.
Listen Memorial Day at noon Central, 11 Mountain, and 7 Central, 6 Mountain, here on SDPB.
Program funding by the South Dakota Humanities Council, promoting reading for all ages with a 2021 Young Readers One book, Imagine Imahina, by Juan Felipe Herrera, featuring English and Spanish text. More at sdhumanities.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. There is a search underway for a missing Lakota woman in Rapid City. Her family says she's been gone for more than 3 weeks. A number of organizations that support missing Indigenous women have joined the search with family, friends, and the Rapid City Police Department. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
30-year-old Susan Fasteagle's last documented contact with people was on May 3rd. She lives in Rapid City and moves between locations. One day, she fell ill. Her husband went to buy her some food, and when he returned, he says Fasteagle was gone. Her family officially reported her missing May 13th. Susan Shockey is Fasteagle's mother-in-law. She says the family got worried when Fasteagle wasn't returning calls.
It's not fair that we have to live in fear. Our women and our children, and there are men out there also, our relatives. It isn't fair that we have to live that way.
Federal studies show in parts of the country with large Native American populations, Native women are killed at rates 10 times higher than the national average. In 2020, the FBI reports that nearly 5,300 Native American women were reported missing. The state attorney general's office reports there are currently 36 Indigenous women missing in South Dakota. Fasteagle is one of the latest to disappear. Members of a number of Native American organizations continue to focus their search for her in Rapid City. Sunny Red Bear is the director of racial equity at Indian Collective. Red Bear is coordinating a timeline of the places Fasteagle frequents. They are also checking several casinos and motels and getting information wherever they can.
So everybody has their own like patterns, right? That they follow every day. You have your own pattern that you follow every day, and that can be learned.
Red Bear says there's a growing awareness of the challenge facing missing and murdered Indigenous people. But she says there's a pivotal moment when education must become action.
Without action, without actually getting out there and doing the searches and demanding change and the grassroots, like the movements within the communities, nothing will ever change. We will just continue to have missing people. This is something that has happened, for hundreds of years.
Wayne Chief Eagle is Fasteagle's brother-in-law. He's known Susan for 15 years and describes her as a kind, caring, soft-spoken person. Chief Eagle is a big fan of Susan's cooking and says she always has a smile, especially for her preteen daughter. He promises his niece he will not stop looking.
You know, I'm going to do what I have to do to help find your mom. So that's why I'm out here, because, you know, I have a heart. I love her as my sister because she's been in our life so long. You know, I'm praying that I hope we don't find her along the creek, because if we do, then, you know, that's bad.
Crews searched for Fasteagle last weekend. Local police continue to look for her as well. Captain James Johns is with the Criminal Investigation Division with the Rapid City Police Department. He says they've been searching for Fasteagle for 2 weeks.
We have exhausted a lot of manpower, put a lot of effort into getting her located. And, the goal is to find her. If she wants to come out and let us know that she's safe, that'd be awesome. But obviously the goal is to make sure that she's safe and that her needs are being met.
John says Fasteagle is also known to travel to Red Shirt, a community on the western edge of the Pine Ridge Reservation. It can complicate a search when a missing person travels between jurisdictions. Lawmakers just approved a new state position, a missing Indigenous persons liaison. That person will coordinate tribal, federal, and state resources to locate missing people. Democratic State Representative Puri Poirier wrote that bill. She says Western South Dakota has such sparse population, it can be easier to commit a crime like kidnapping.
We have gaps in jurisdictions. Perpetrators know. You know, anyone who makes that commute from Rapid City to Pine Ridge knows the commute. Anyone can pick up anybody and drive off. It is such a desolate rural area.
Poirier says the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women presents a perfect storm, the culmination of historical trauma and underfunded public health and safety programs.
It has to be improved on and under public awareness and understanding of that, instead of a general sense of bewilderment of why things are the way they are.
As the searches for Susan Fast Eagle continue, her mother-in-law, Susan Shockey, remains optimistic.
I have hope that we'll find her. I want Susan to come home, to give us the call.
Family members and friends say they will continue to look for Susan Fast Eagle. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
Susan Fast Eagle is 5'3" tall. She has hazel eyes and light brown hair. She weighs about 150 pounds. If you have information about the location of Susan Fast Eagle, please call the Pennington County Sheriff's Office at 605-394-4139. If you'd rather, you can also call the Saanich Scouts at 701-893-6841. Those reports can be anonymous. For photos of Susan Fast Eagle and video of the search, go to our website at sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, we look across the border to Minnesota for insight into how that state is striving to address the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. You're in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, New York Times reporter Nick Corasaniti talks about new voting laws proposed in Republican-controlled legislatures to restrict voting rights, limit ballot initiatives which could undermine Republican goals, and stiffen penalties for poll workers and election officials who make even minor mistakes. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, One Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
For months, unions have been calling on the government to issue emergency rules to protect workers from COVID, but now...
A lot of workplaces have high levels of people being vaccinated. The backdrop to this whole issue has really shifted considerably.
Still, some experts say these rules are more important than ever to protect low-wage workers. That debate this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This month, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is shining a spotlight on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. You can tune in tonight to South Dakota Focus with Jackie Hendry on SDPB-TV for a special hour-long program on the crisis in South Dakota. But today on In the Moment, we look to other states to find out how they are addressing this issue. Minnesota State Senator Mary Kunish was the chief author of legislation that created a missing and murdered Indigenous task force in Minnesota. Nicole Martin Rogers is senior researcher at Wilder Research in St. Paul and a descendant of White Earth Nation. And Lydia Moran is associate editor at Minnesota Women's Press. Minnesota Women's Press is one of the longest running feminist print and digital platforms in the U.S., and they have released a special edition entirely dedicated to missing and murdered Indigenous women. All three leaders join us now. Senator Kunish, welcome to In the Moment. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for this invitation to discuss the work we're doing here in Minnesota.
Nicole Martin Rogers, welcome as well.
Thank you for having me.
Lydia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Lydia, I want to start with you to sort of ground us in the work that you did at Minnesota Women's Press, dedicating this entire issue to the crisis in Minnesota. Tell me a little bit about how you came to that as a staff and some of the work, the emotional work of putting that together.
Of course. So Minnesota Women's Press is an independent monthly magazine that was founded as a weekly newspaper in the Twin Cities in 1985. And our original purpose, which continues today, is to amplify the stories that Minnesota women care about and to value them as the experts on their own lives. And our most popular coverage areas are healing trauma and equity and justice. And so we have known that the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis in our state, we've known about that for a long time, and it has gotten coverage, but not to the extent that it deserves. And we also learned from the task force report out of the Minnesota legislature that the local media here can play a role in perpetuating injustice by reinforcing stereotypes, such as referencing a victim's drug use, rather than electing to cover the wide systemic issues at play when someone goes missing. So with that in mind, our April issue was exclusively about the crisis, and we were able to publish 15 stories by women who are gathering data, providing resources to those affected by violence, and stories from those who have experienced being sex trafficked themselves or are close to someone who is gone.
We're going to talk a little bit about the challenges of gathering that data here in a moment with Nicole Martin Rogers, but I want to start next with Senator Kunesh, because your work in the state legislature for Minnesota, you're passionate about this topic, and you're one of the first people kind of bringing this current effort forward. Tell me a little bit about your connection to this subject matter. It's personal for you.
It is. It's very personal. My mother and my grandfather were enrolled members of Standing Rock Tribe, and I remember growing up and hearing the stories and the phone calls coming from family on the reservation and the quiet kind of whispering around my mother's cousin Elsie when she was missing and then later found dead. It was deemed a suicide, but as we now have looked back and gathered information, I'm pretty convinced that it was a murder gone bad after she had perhaps been misused by some men. But this was a really important sort of an epiphany for me after listening to Canada's report. And then it was the exact summer that Savannah LaFontaine Graywin went missing in North Dakota. And my thoughts were, why is the United States not doing a study on this? Why isn't there a task force? If North Dakota is creating legislation, why isn't Minnesota? And as a fresh new legislator, I had that moment of epiphany, like, wait a minute, that's my job. I am a legislator. I am of Native descent. It is now the time to educate and bring this to the front and start working on it here in Minnesota. And so that's what we did.
Yeah. If not you, who, right? If not me, who has, who brings
exactly.
This to, how hard was it, Senator, to convince other lawmakers that this was worthy of a task force? Because it always comes down to, well, how much money are you going to ask us for?
That's exactly it. So the first year that I brought this legislation forward, it was even more difficult to get even an initial hearing in the House. I served 4 years in the House of Representatives, and I have just finished my first year as a senator. So I was a new House member, didn't have those connections or relationships, and I was in the minority as a Democrat. The Republicans were in the majority. And so it took a lot of work to lobby that bill. I had to educate a lot of legislators on both sides of the aisle on the issue. And people would just look at me with big round eyes like, what? What is this? How long has this been happening? Where is this happening? And they had no idea that this was such a historic, dramatic pandemic that's gone on generation after generation. And it was quite serendipitous how we finally, at the last day, got our first hearing. And when our women came in to testify and tell their stories, not just of loved ones that have passed, but survivors or family members who lost loved ones, that had an incredible, huge impact. We didn't pass it that year. The task force, but we did the very next year and we continued the work. And it was the stories, it was the personal trauma that legislators heard for the first time and got behind it 100% in the House. It took a little more work in the Senate. That was, again, Republican controlled, but they eventually recognized the need for the task force and with very minimal dollars and a lot of dedicated, passionate people, we were able to complete that task force and put a report in front of the legislature within about 18 months.
That report is, I think, more than 165 pages. And Nicole Martin Rogers, I want to bring you into this conversation now. She's senior researcher at Wilder Research in St. Paul and a descendant of the White Earth Nation. Nicole, you explain so well how difficult the story is powerful. When you look at the data, it is really hard to pin down. I'm sure you've been asked this question a lot. Can you explain why is it so hard to pin down? Why do we still not know how many Indigenous women are missing or how many Indigenous women have been killed, women and girls?
It is a good question, and it is one that we've been asked a bit during this process. And I think that there's a lot of different ways to answer it. The first obvious answer is that there's not a single database in the state of Minnesota or nationally or in any other state that I'm aware of that tracks both missing and murdered people in one place, right? There's a number of different databases. There's a missing persons clearinghouse, and then there's a database tracking homicides. There's also different categories of homicides. There's also missing unidentified dead bodies that we don't know who they are. And within all of these different data systems, there's also the problem of misclassification of race. So sometimes American Indian people aren't classified correctly. And there's a problem of underreporting. So in the instance of missing persons, you know, sometimes we run across, we heard a number of instances during the task force process of women who had gone missing, but law enforcement declined to actually officially report them as missing because they knew of the woman's history with prostitution or drug abuse or other things and sort of deemed her to have gone off partying or something and she'll show back up. So then it doesn't reach the point of getting to an official report. There's also jurisdictional issues. So sometimes there's multiple different jurisdictions and law enforcement agencies involved, and it's not clear which one of them is going to be doing the reporting. So there's all of these barriers to getting good, accurate data and to having it all in one place. There are some voluntary databases like the Sovereign Bodies Institute that does try to keep track, but that's not a mandatory reporting system. That's just somebody who's taking their own time and taking it upon themselves to do it. And then the other thing that I would say, too, is that there's a lot of stuff that leads up to someone becoming missing or murdered. And there's a lot of other data systems that we need to look to understand those sort of upstream cases. So, for example, in Minnesota, the Department of Human Services reported that 601 American Indian children went missing out of their out-of-home placements between 2015 and 2019. And many of those children may end up being trafficked or other exploitation situations that is sort of a direct pathway to becoming MMIW. So, you know, all the data from all those different systems has to be considered if you really want to get a true picture of understanding where this injustice comes from. Mm.
So Sovereign Bodies Institute says more than 173, I think, women in South Dakota are listed as missing and murdered. And tell me, Nicole, and that's, you know, comprehensive number, when you worked through this report for the state of Minnesota, Nicole, what are some of the key findings that you found about how significant this problem is? You know, the data that people can really hang their hats on and say, this is the best we could find out right now. How bad is the problem?
Well, I think that we can see in Minnesota, and I'm sure this is probably true in South Dakota and a lot of other states as well, that there's these systemic risk factors that lead to the MMIW injustice, right? So it's not just an individual woman who's made poor lifestyle choices or had bad behavior that led her into this situation. There's these systemic factors like poverty, Indigenous people are much more likely to experience poverty and homelessness and housing insecurity. And all of those issues put a woman or girl or Indigenous person at risk of becoming exploited because they're desperate and they need help. And if there's a trafficker or other exploiter who's there waiting for them, that can be one way that the systemic risk for Indigenous people increases. Indigenous women are far more likely to be victims of domestic violence. Indigenous women are far more likely to be trafficked than women of other races. And so all of these risk factors add up in the Indigenous community to the injustice that we see. Hmm.
Senator Kunesh, I'm looking at the executive summary from the task force's report. And, you know, as people hear Nicole talk, they can, you know, it sort of sinks in how comprehensive this is, how unacceptable it is. But as I read the report, I also see calls to action that are doable. There are things that can be done starting in the place that we are at now. What needs to happen next in your mind?
Well, I think our next step is to create a permanent Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office here in Minnesota so that we can continue the work that we've started. One of the most important things that came out of our report was after a hearing from one of the leaders from Canada's report, that putting the report on a shelf and letting it gather dust is totally useless after gathering what we have and hearing those stories. So we are very intent on creating that MMIR office so that we can have the ongoing attention and leadership to this issue and funding it adequately, which we found is not so expensive. I were thinking like $1 million for 2 years just to start an office with four employees. But it's really important that we have the ability to disseminate the information that we've gathered. So we'd like to create a dashboard that would allow the public to see that with transparency the work that is being done, but also allow other states and other organizations to see what we have been able to put in place and then continue to address the issue systemically around housing and poverty and education. And one of the interesting points that we had just this past week when we met as our last meeting in the task force, I asked the different commissioners and agencies, have you made in-house or systemic changes organically without being told to do it or mandated by the legislature that are going to have positive changes? And they said yes. So just by bringing the commissioners on board and agency leaders, they are able to look at the work that they are doing or have been doing and what they can do to tweak and educate their own agencies in order to begin to address these issues. So, you know, creating that office is just the beginning, because then we'll be able to ensure that there are state and federal funds coming down towards it, and then also that we're able to access some of the federal resources that will support not just the task force, but also allowing tribes to have access and being able to participate, especially in shared and collaborative data systems.
Yeah. Lydia Moran, we are doing this coverage as an ongoing project for South Dakota Public Broadcasting. This special issue of Minnesota Women's Press is, I think, the most comprehensive print publication I've seen dealing with not only the data and the history, but also the emotional stories of this. Tell listeners here in South Dakota, if you would, how they can access that issue and learn more.
Yeah, you can find the issue by heading to womenspress.com, that's all one word, and clicking on the digital edition button, which is on the top right-hand side of the page. And there you can find the full digital MMIW issue. And if you'd like a print copy mailed to you, please email editor@womenspress.com. And you can also find that address on our contact page at womenspress.com.
Lydia Moran, Associate Editor of Minnesota Women's Press, thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Martin Rogers, Senior Researcher at Wilder Research in St. Paul, thank you as well for your work.
Chi Miigwech, thank you for having me.
And Minnesota State Senator Mary Kunish, we appreciate your time as well.
Kilamia, it's my pleasure to be able to share the good work that we've done.
We will put a link up on our website to the special Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women issue of Minnesota Women's Press. It's on today's In the Moment episode page at sdpb.org/news. And you can find all of South Dakota Public Broadcasting Spotlight coverage online. Go to sdpb.org/spotlight and tune in tonight for Jackie Hendry and South Dakota Focus on SDPB-TV that airs at 8 p.m. Central, 7 Mountain. Let's take a moment now and head to Spearfish, South Dakota. People all over the world come here in the fall to simply take a drive through the canyon, trying to time their journey with the perfect unfolding of autumn colors. But Spearfish is abundant with adventure year-round. Tonight, for example, you can chill and cheer at the home opener of the Spearfish Sasquatch as they take on the Badland Big Sticks in the new Expedition League. Or on June 12th, one of Spearfish's signature events, the Gold Rush Gravel Grinder, commences. Cyclists hit the hills and trails. The bike race has prizes for everything from best dressed to best poetry. That's right, you can email the event coordinators a poem you wrote on your ride. The weather in Spearfish for today's baseball opener is a bit chilly at 45 degrees, but the morning fog should dissipate to some partly cloudy skies. Look for warmer weather this weekend with highs in the 60s. The humidity is high, but the chance of rain today is only about 10%. Paul Higby writes for South Dakota Magazine, and he knows a lot about Spearfish, like how old its famous fish hatchery is.
Well, this year is the 125th anniversary of the federal fish hatchery being established by an act of Congress in 1896. And then 3 years later, in 1899, the first trout were placed there and grown there and then put in milk cans and put into streams throughout the Black Hills.
Trout in the Black Hills, vibrant and abundant because more than a century ago, scientists transported them in milk cans to feed the rivers and streams. Where are your favorite places to visit in South Dakota? What are some unexpected places in your town that pull people to your history, your dining, your culture? Tell us a story. Email us inthemoment@sdpb.org. Ahead on the program, hardy plants for people who aren't sure they have a green thumb, but still like pretty things. I'm Lori Walsh. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. After George Floyd's murder, Ithaca, New York, decided to turn its police force into a public safety department with many unarmed officers.
They don't want somebody to show up with a weapon and in uniform. But still, there's a need for a public safety response for so many things, from people having a mental health crisis to people who just need to file a report, say for a stolen bicycle.
Next time, here now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by a co-op agreement with the U.S. Small Business Administration. If COVID-19 impacted your business, SDCEO Women's Business Center offers complimentary confidential advice. More at bhsu.edu/SDCEO.
As people look to get away for long-awaited vacations, they are running into some unwelcome surprises with their rental cars.
It was like over $1,000 for a week. I was like, oh no, this is way too much.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. How the post-pandemic travel boom caught the car rental industry off guard. That's next time on Marketplace.
tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding by Arts South Dakota, the Annual Arts Education Institute, Band Director Institute, and First Annual Choral Director Institute go online July 12th through the 16th with grad credit available. Register at artssouthdakota.org.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Well, by now, listeners know I don't have much of a green thumb, even though I do love to be outside, reading mostly while my tortoise explores the backyard. But thanks to Eric Helland and SDPB's South Dakota Home Garden, I've learned there are some plants that even I can grow. And Eric Helland is president and CEO of Landscape Garden Centers in Sioux Falls. He joins us today to talk about a few of those hearty plants. Eric, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Lori, how are you?
I am doing well. Tortoises can't eat hostas, but I can grow them. They are one. They're on your list, aren't they?
Yes, I call them the bulletproof plants. There's a handful of them, and there's of course a bunch of other ones that do really well, but ones that are just tried and true and plants that you can share. So once they start growing, they get to a larger size. They're really easy to divide, cut up, and then share and let other people have success gardening.
All right, let's talk about well-drained soil, because that is important to all of these plants. And you say it a lot. What exactly does it mean? How do you test it?
Okay, so one of the good way to test it is dig your hole and then pour water into it and let it drain and then pour some more water into it and then see how fast it drains after that, especially if you're dealing with really super dry soil. If it's already really saturated, you're going to be able to tell how well it's draining. And you want that water to just drain out of there within an hour or for sure within a few hours. Some plants can't handle water sitting around for a day or so, but you really want well drained, because if you don't, it's basically the plant is drowning. The plant needs to have moisture to conduct its job of photosynthesis and all of that other jazz, but it can't be submerged underwater because it needs to interact with both moisture, the soil, and air that is down and around the soil. So that's the key part.
Are you stuck with the soil you have, or can you create well-drained soil in the area that you sort of want your plants to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. And most of the plants that we replace are because it's been overwatered, never underwatered. Mm. And usually it is because it's in poor drained soil. And so one way you can do it, one way is to make sure the water slopes away from your plant, so that way it's not in a bowl. Mm-hmm. The other way you can do it, too, is if you dig your hole really deep, like twice or three times deeper than what the plant is, and then fill that up with rock, and then that way the water will sit below the plant and out of the root system, and then that will help. It doesn't always work, but we call it kind of a French drain underneath a plant. And then that way the water is sitting down below the root zone.
Yeah. All right. I mentioned hostas. I also have some successful daylilies, which you talked to me about, I think, last season. What else is for people like me who we like pretty things, but we don't want to put a lot of effort into them.
I did a segment with the South Dakota Public TV, and we were talking about Dicentra, which is bleeding heart, which every person, as they're growing up, their grandmother probably had those. And those are kind of cool because they look very tender. They look difficult just because their foliage is so soft.
Yeah.
But they're really, really tough plants. Iris is another one. Iris are the ones that will keep on continuing to multiply, so make sure you put those in kind of a space where they will be surrounded, like even by within a concrete sidewalk area or between the garage and concrete, a sidewalk. Mm-hmm. That helps. Those can be a lot of fun to grow and very easy. Dianthus, there's lots of different kinds of dianthus that are out there, which is basically your carnation. Those can do very well also.
Well, Eric Helland, it's a great place to start. I know it has helped me get started and really enjoy those outdoor reading sessions that I like to have, because I am a little less on the weeding and more on the reading. Eric, thanks for being here with us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
All right, let's talk about a few ways you can be part of the SDPB gardening and growing community. You can turn in Thursdays here to hear Eric Helland, and he'll answer your questions. You just have to send us an email in the moment at sdpb.org. Anytime throughout the week, we'll get your questions in queue. You can also join other South Dakota gardeners on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Use the hashtag SDHomeGarden. Now, this is a digital series, so you can see Eric Helland to dig a hole and teach you about well-drained soil. New segments of that digital series are posted every week at sdpb.org/SDHomeGarden. Also, broadcast on SDPB TV through September 12th. Tune in Thursdays after Frankie Drake, Saturdays after Carol Burnett, and again after Father Brown, and Sundays they're on after Midsummer Murders.
Friday night, and I roll out to the bars with the best friends a man could ever have. Have a drink, maybe one or two or more, a whole lot more. That's about the time that I met you.
Live music is returning to venues and sidewalks and band shells across the state. You heard a little music there from Nick Lynn. We can't tell you the name of that song because the FCC would not approve. He is a Black Hills-based pianist who performs covers along with his own original music, and you can see him tonight and Saturday at Firehouse Brewing Company in Rapid City beginning at 8:30 p.m. local time each night. Hey, Nick, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Don't say the name of your music because it's not, but you can say it in the bar.
Yeah, not that one.
So tell us a little bit about what, you know, music live coming back into a space with real people listening. What has the pandemic been like for you as a performer and a creator of music?
Oh, well, when the pandemic hit, it was, you know, scary, and I stopped playing music live for months and months and months. And then when it started happening again, it trickled in, but people were very grateful. Like people really appreciated live music, and not like they don't usually, but I felt really glad to listen to live music again.
Yeah. You play covers, you play original music. What makes a good set for those listeners and really for you?
Well, I try to play songs that people know and people like and that people request. So if I'm getting some reactions and people are interested or they feel comfortable to come and request a few songs and, you know, like hopefully I can do them, then that's fun for everybody.
Yeah. And you got a piano, a keyboard. Tell me a little bit, because a lot of people, you know, travel with a guitar on their back. What does your setup look like?
Oh, it takes a little bit. I've got a keyboard in a Gator case, so I wheel that around, and but it's heavy, but it's a nice little workout for my sets. And then, you know, if some places have pianos, which is nice, that reduces what I've got to do. You know, the Tinderbox has a grand piano. Firehouse Winery has a grand piano sitting there, so that always makes things simpler.
Yeah. What does the audience sort of feedback and that connection mean for you? You know, you mentioned sort of people coming up and asking you what to play. Does that help you catch the mood of the room and respond accordingly?
Oh, well, anybody, if you can do somebody's request and do it well, then it makes them really happy. And then they're really involved. And then their friends might request a song, or another group might request, or they might just, we're doing, you know, so.
What's popular? What popular requests do you get that you're able to play?
Oh, well, of course, I had to learn Piano Man long ago. I learned to play a harmonica with that. I got like a little neck yoke thing that I put on and do that because, you know, every time I went out doing open mics when I was first starting playing,
I got the request a lot. I just hated saying no, so I had to buckle down and memorize it.
Yeah, well, this, how long is that song? It's kind of a doozy.
Oh, Piano Man?
Yeah, oh, like five.
It's not long as like American Pie.
Oh, sure, yeah. Is that a piano tune, though? I don't know.
What's that?
Anything. Anything can be a piano tune, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, people kind of, they want to hear Billy Joel, Elton John, Coldplay, Beatles, and that's kind of been like the, but then any piano song, Desperado,
sure.
Ophelia from Lumineers,
yeah.
Has nice piano stuff in it. So people will just sit there and think about what would sound good with piano, and then they'll request it, and then I'll go home and try to figure it out.
Yeah, so, but tell us a little bit about your original music. What kinds of things do you like to really add to that canon of piano music that someday someone will be coming up and asking another artist, hey, will you play this?
Oh, boy, it's fun to have original music and have people know, like that song that I can't say the title of. I play that often at the Tinderbox, and so people will actually request it.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of fun. That's fun when people learn your music enough that they want to hear it again.
Yeah. We're going to close the show today with a little Eternity of Yesterday. Tell us a little bit about this this song and where it came from for you.
Oh, this one is more of a serious song that has more meaning. It was kind of a time in my life where I was, I don't know, regretting some life choices that I've made and thinking about, oh, if I just had made this one choice, you know, 5-10 years ago or whatever, then I would have gone in a different direction and, you know, my life wouldn't be where it was presently.
Yeah.
But then I thought about, you know, the people that were in my life that wouldn't be in it if I had gone a different direction.
Yeah. So. Nick Lynn, we're glad that you're in our life. And you can see him and have him in your life tonight and Saturday, 8:30 at Firehouse Brewing Company in Rapid City.
Is it
Friday night? Friday and Saturday. If you miss him there, he's going to be back in July. And you can also catch him at the Tinderbox in Rapid City, June 18th through the 19th at 8 p.m. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. Tomorrow on the show, Richard Tubbles joins us to talk about a relative that was missing for decades before being identified. Here is a Nick Lynn with Eternity of Yesterday. And thank you for listening.
That I wouldn't have you.